The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And for the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from National Geographic. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, I want to remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we'll be reading. These are simply selected for your enjoyment and edification. Now, on today's Armchair Traveler, we're going to meet a group of scientists that are seeking survivors from the dinosaur age. Now, this article is from the April 2025 issue of National Geographic. It's written by Hannah Nordhaus, photographs taken by Jennifer Hayes. As the introductory photo explains, for 162 million years, sturgeons have fended off everything they have ever faced until humans pushed them to the brink of extinction. Now, inside, we're going to learn about the urgent fight to protect the last of these living fossils. And our story will begin in Kazakhstan and also include stops in Wisconsin and Italy. So come and enjoy the journey as we begin. The river flows vast and soundless. It's December in southern Kazakhstan, and the landscape near the Sir-Doya River is smudged in shades of brown and taupe. Dormant grasses, silted floodplains, leafless trees. This is not the most picturesque stretch of riverbank, strewn as it is with food, wrappers, bottles, a decomposing sedan. Overhead, the sun is obscured by a haze of coal and wood smoke. But when it comes to what Bernie Kahuda is searching for, the spot feels perfect. This is the habitat we need, says Kahuda, an aquatic conservation biologist with the Tennessee Aquarium Conservation Institute. He's hoping to find a species of sturgeon, the Sir-Doya, that's native to these waters but hasn't been seen since the 1960s after a series of Soviet dams was built throughout the river system. Those projects blocked access to the fish's spawning grounds and forever changed the flow of the Sir-Doya, which drains from the high peaks of Kazakhstan into what is now the remnants of the Aral Sea. If the sturgeon somehow still exists, Kahuda thinks the silty, shallow expanse of river is where it can be found. Some months earlier, Kahuda had been contacted by the conservation organization ReWild, which administers a program to search for what it calls lost species, creatures that haven't been seen for at least a decade and could be extinct, but there's not enough data to be conclusive. The officials at ReWild reached out to Kahuda, knowing that he was one of a very small collection of scientists who have ever laid eyes on the Sir-Doya sturgeon. As a graduate student in the 1990s, he visited museums in London, Moscow, and St. Petersburg, and videotaped 27 spindled specimens, bleached white from years of storage. They said, "You're the expert," Kahuda says, remembering the call with ReWild, and I said, "Well, I've seen them dead in a jar." The Sir-Doya sturgeon is a distinctive-looking fish, and at maximum length of roughly 9 inches, it's the smallest of the 26 species of sturgeons. The largest is the beluga, the biggest ever recorded, pulled from the Volga River in 1827, measuring more than 23 feet and weighing over 3,200 pounds. All sturgeons have a long, flat snout, dangling, whisker-like barbels that detect bottom-dwelling prey, and 5 lines of horny, bony scutes that climb vertically up the length of their bodies. It's hard to mistake this ancient fish for anything else. Cross a catfish, a shark, a stegosaurus, and a pruning saw, and you're not far from imagining a sturgeon. For 162 million years, they lived through the climate swings, continental shifts, volcanic eruptions, and a mass extinction. They survived the asteroid that killed the dinosaurs, everything that nature and space could throw at them, says Kahuda, everything except humanity. Today, they are the most endangered group of fish in the world. Since 1970, global sturgeon populations have dropped a catastrophic 94%. The International Union for Conservation of Nature, IUCN, lists 25 sturgeon species as vulnerable or endangered, 17 critically so, and one species is extinct in the wild. 3 of the critically endangered species, including the Sir-Doya, are feared extinct as well. Ecologically, sturgeons are on the brink. Economically, they're some of the most valuable animals on Earth. Much of the sturgeon's decline can be attributed to overfishing. Caviar, the fish's profuse obsidian eggs, salted and sold across the globe as an edible symbol of status and wealth. Some tins surpass $600 an ounce. But even for species like the Sudaya that aren't sought for their roe, human-made decisions and environmental changes have been devastating. It took only 200 years for humans to destroy every riverine habitat where sturgeons live, Kahuta says. Sturgeons evolved over 160 million years ago in free-flowing rivers, places without barriers. All sturgeons migrate, says Kahuta. There are now simply too many things in their way. Dams, reservoirs, dredging, and irrigation diversions block migration to spawning grounds upstream and strand larvae floating downstream. Runoff from agriculture can create toxic algal blooms, while development, logging, and mining destroy spawning habitat and produce harmful sediments. Kahuta hopes some small number of Sudaya sturgeons have survived this age of man. If the fish can be found, Kahuta will follow a now well-worn playbook: capture a breeding population of males and females, set them up in a hatchery, and raise them for reintroduction into the wild. Where there are dams blocking spawning routes, there are now hatchery and transport programs. Where there was overfishing, there are now laws and institutions banning or limiting unsustainable harvest. Even the caviar industry is now playing a role in bringing sturgeons back from the brink. Before arriving at the river, Kahuta had stopped at a roadside fishmonger stand and passed around a printed photo of those museum specimens. Trucks groaned past the highway as a fisherman studied the picture and then confirmed that he had pulled something similar out of the water a few years back, which made Kahuta even more excited to get into the river. Making their way toward the water, Kahuta and his colleague, Dave Neely, carry a custom-sewn net they will use to sweep the river. Three Kazakh fisheries officials have driven down from the Aral Sea in a big Soviet-era truck to supervise the efforts to find the lost fish. One of them, Tenisbek Barakatbekev, leans against the old vehicle, watching as Kahuta and Neely wade into the river. "We have a chance," he says, "but this chance is very small. We can hope." It's April, and Wisconsin's Wolf River is teeming with sturgeons. The wolf prowl the rocks near the banks, their fins breaching the water in the frothy spillway of the Shawano Dam, which lies between a paper mill on one side of the river and the town of Shawano's Sturgeon Park, a tiered greenway at the river's edge. Since the barrier's construction in 1892, this has marked the furthest point up the river where the sturgeons can swim. A crowd is beginning to gather along the banks to watch this annual rite of spring in which thousands of sturgeons swim from Lake Winnebago, 125 miles downstream, to spawn. These fish are a small number of the roughly 40,000 adult sturgeons in the Lake Winnebago system. Wisconsin's statewide lake sturgeon population is one of the healthiest in the planet. Theirs is a comeback story that sturgeon advocates are seeking to emulate around the world. Sturgeons were once so abundant in North American rivers that, according to indigenous lore, you could walk across the water on the fish's back. Lake sturgeons, the fish that are spawning below Shawano Dam and top out at around 7 feet, once ranged from the Great Lakes and Hudson Bay south to the Mississippi watershed. But by the 1970s, they had been largely wiped out of many of their native rivers. In Wisconsin, sturgeon populations had plunged years earlier, but foresighted management averted disaster. In 1915, the state banned all fishing for lake sturgeons for a time, then carefully tinkered with catch and size requirements that are still in place. Those catch limits are set by Margaret Stadig, and she's the state's so-called sturgeon general, a moniker that tends to stick to all sturgeon bosses. Stadig is a fisheries biologist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, charged with overseeing the health of the Lake Winnebago population. She also collaborates with the federal government on a breeding program meant to restore lake sturgeon numbers across their former range. This is her first spawning season. Her predecessor pleaded no contest to misdemeanor charges of theft of caviar. And as she stands along the Wolf River watching the sturgeons prepare to spawn, she points to a female moving slowly along the rocks bloated with eggs. "She looks like a Goodyear blimp," Stadig says, noting the males are thinner and sleeker, more like torpedoes. They're more active, too, jumping out of the water from time to time, their bodies vibrating like plucked guitar strings. When a female sturgeon is ready to spawn, a group of males surrounds her, thumping her abdomen with their tails so vigorously that an onlooker perched on the riverbank can feel the rocks shake until she extrudes her eggs thousands at a time. The eggs and milt fish sperm meet and settle on the rocks or gravel at the bottom of the river, hatching as larvae a week later to ride the spring runoff back down the river. They vibrate when they spawn, Stedig says, referring to what the locals call sturgeon thunder. Once the thunder begins, Stedig's team, which is here to count and characterize the fish, also gets busy, netting the sturgeons and laying them on a tarp. One team member holds a fish's head, another the tail, while a third scans for telemetric tags that indicate whether the fish has been caught before. Stedig will set next year's fishing harvest caps using an algorithm based on numbers of tagged and untagged fish. Thanks to these quotas, the Wolf River sturgeons are now healthy enough to sustain their own numbers. Federal officials hope to build on that success by breeding Wolf River sturgeons to restock rivers in other states. After each fish is measured, sexed, and tagged, it is handed off to a group from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which collects eggs and milt from the female and male sturgeons, mixes them together with a turkey feather, it's soft enough not to damage the eggs as they're stirred, then transports the fertilized eggs back to the Warm Springs National Fish Hatchery in Georgia. About a month later, grow-out facilities like the Tennessee Aquarium, where Cahuta works, pick up the fish and raise them in tanks, feeding them a diet of brine shrimp and bloodworms. After the fish have grown 6 inches long, they are released into rivers where sturgeons were long ago wiped out by overfishing, dredging, pollution, and dams. Since 2000, the aquarium and its partners have reintroduced more than 300,000 lake sturgeons into the Tennessee and Cumberland rivers, hoping they will thrive in the stretches between dams. The first females are just now reaching reproductive age, somewhere north of 20 years in lake sturgeons, though Cahuta and his team have yet to see evidence that the reintroduced fish have successfully spawned, and the larvae have survived the perilous float through the river's system's many stagnant reservoirs to transform into juvenile fish. But restocked lake sturgeons have reproduced in river systems with longer free-flowing stretches in the Coosa River Basin in Georgia, and the researchers continue to hope. When you start a sturgeon regeneration program, you're in it for a century, says Cahuta, who joined the team in Wisconsin to collect fin clips to chart hatchery genetics. It's a long-term investment, he added. Before Stedig's team finishes its work, members count out 73 sturgeons to deliver to the Menapee tribe, whose reservation lies above the Shawano Dam. For thousands of years, the Menominee people gathered each spring for a feast and ceremony. We would wait for the sturgeons to come long after winter months, says David Grignon, the tribe's historic preservation officer. When the dam was built more than 130 years ago, the sturgeon migration was blocked and the ceremony ceased. A century later, thanks to the state's recovery efforts, Wisconsin officials, in collaboration with the tribe, began hauling the fish around the dams. They transport them up in big trucks and tanks each spring, says Grignon, and the tribe revived its ceremony that features dancers who mimic the movement of the sturgeons up the river. Tribal officials are also working to install a passage in one dam to restore the natural migration of sturgeons to the reservation. But for now, sturgeon generals like Stedig must serve as midwives, too, trucking the fish across unbreachable human boundaries. Ironically, the very industry that caused the decline of so many sturgeons species is now playing a key role in their comeback. At his family's sturgeon farm outside of Milan, Italy, Sergio Giovanni stands on a metal grill above the water and points beneath his feet to a fish named Cavallo. Today, most of the world's caviar is produced in aquaculture facilities like this one, farms that sturgeon advocates hope can play a part in saving many European caviar species. The Giovannini family raises 300,000 Adriatic, Russian, starlet, and stellate sturgeons to sell on the global market. Most of these fish will be sold for caviar and meat, not Cavallo. Everyone had assumed Cavallo, which was sleek and jumped like a stallion, was a male, hence the masculine name. But In 2020, after the family moved Cavallo from a site fed by spring water to the farm's river-fed tanks, Cavallo produced eggs for the first time. She was around 50 years old. Now she's contributing those eggs to the future of the species. We give this lady sturgeon river water, and after 3 years, 4 years, miracles happen, Giovanni says. It's also something of a miracle that Cavallo and the other Adriatic sturgeons on the farm exist at all. Sergio's father, Jacinto, purchased Cavallo around 60 other Adriatic sturgeons from fishermen on the Po River and its tributaries in the mid-1970s, before Sergio was born. They were among the last wild Adriatic sturgeons captured alive. The species was designated by the IUCN as critically endangered and possibly extinct in the wild in 2010. Though Jacinto had experienced breeding trout and pike, he had no idea how to breed sturgeons in captivity. He had heard the Soviets had been successfully fertilizing Caspian sturgeon species since the 1860s. In the 1940s, their scientists figured out how to induce ovulation with injections of pituitary hormones, and in 1969, they retrieved the eggs using laparotomies, invasive surgeries to access the gametes, much like human cesarean sections. When Jacinto sought the Soviets' help for Adriatic sturgeons in 1978, they refused. Instead, he learned through trial and error with the assistance of French and Italian scientists. In 1988, around the time wild sturgeon fishing was largely banned, he finally succeeded using a non-invasive stripping method, applying gentle pressure to a ripe female's abdomen to squeeze the eggs out of the fish. No incisions required. Soon after, he distributed his first Adriatic fingerlings to conservation organizations for restocking, and then, in the 1990s, he began raising Adriatic and other species for caviar production as well. It's thought every Adriatic sturgeon in the world today is descended from the breeding stock Jacinto collected in the 70s. Looking back, says Beate Striebelgritte of the Worldwide Fund for Nature Sturgeon Initiative, you can say the Giovannini's have probably saved the Adriatic sturgeon. Well, experts hope these efforts can protect other species, such as the Russian and starlet sturgeons and the belugas, the grandest, most coveted of them all. Belugas came under crushing population pressure when sturgeon numbers crashed in the 20th century as a result of overfishing and dam construction. A black market free-for-all then flourished, with egg-bearing beluga females estimated to have fetched as much as $3 million each. Belugas could once be found and fished in northern Italy. Now they're gone from Italian rivers and found only in very small numbers in the Caspian and Black Seas and on farms. While the illegal and caviar trade persist, expanding aquaculture makes it less lucrative. When I kill fish with my right hand, with my left I can also be involved with conservation, says Sergio Giovannini's brother John, who along with Sergio continues to provide breeding stock for ongoing Adriatic sturgeon reintroduction efforts. For the Giovannini's, the farm sturgeons travel by truck to caviar processor Agrotica Lombarda in the nearby industrial town of Cavassano. Agrotica Lombarda processes almost 31 tons of caviar each year. Unlike the Giovannini's breeding program, the caviar harvest still requires killing the fish. The sturgeons are unloaded into a V-shaped slaughtering trough, then moved to processing rooms, where employees clad in surgical gloves and gowns remove the ovaries and pull out hundreds of thousands of glistening dark eggs, accounting for up to 25% of a fish's total weight. Then rinse, taste, grade, weigh, salt, pack, press, and finally can and label them for sale. During the processing, tiny black rows scatter across the tables, wash buckets, and floor. When you buy caviar, you don't buy the eggs of sturgeon. You buy a perception, says Paolo Branzi, president of World Sturgeon Conservation Society. A luxury product, something special just for rich people. Champagne, caviar, and ice girl. In the grading room, one of the workers offers me a taste of Osestra caviar from the critically endangered Russian sturgeon. It's true, it tastes like abundance, birth, salt, sea, life. In Kazakhstan, on the banks of the Sudaria, the Kazakh fisheries officials smoke cigarettes and wait, sympathetic, as Kahuta struggles to keep his footing on the silty river bottom. He and Neely drag a net beneath the surface on their first pass. They pull up countless branches and cockle burrs, along with a few minnows. At the riverbank, they place each species they capture into a plexiglass container to measure and photograph, then untangle the net and wade back in the current, hoping that the next pass will dredge up a sturgeon. No scientist has seen more than 50 years and pave a way toward its recovery. Work like this is making an impact, thanks to scientists and aquaculture experts like Ahuda Stadick and the Giovannini's. Sturgeon populations have begun to recover. In eastern North America, populations of Atlantic, Gulf, and Lake sturgeons have all mounted comebacks from the lows of the past century. Reintroduced hatchery fish, like those from Wisconsin's Wolf River, have returned to their native watersheds everywhere from New York to Minnesota to Germany to China, and in some places are beginning to reproduce for the first time in decades. By 2021, after more than 30 years of restocking, scientists had discovered one beached egg-bearing female and had detected juveniles in three Italian rivers, suggesting the restocked fish may have begun reproducing again in the wild. In April 2024, captive-bred Yangtze sturgeons spawned in their native habitat for the first time, almost 2 years after a panel of international experts had declared the fish extinct in the wild. The world sturgeon generals haven't given up the most critically endangered species either. Cahuta helped identify the last Alabama sturgeon netted in the wild in 2007. Biologists continue to comb the Alabama River for its namesake, sturgeon, and found the fish's DNA in the waters there. Sadly, Cahuta won't find a Sirdarya sturgeon on this expedition to Kazakhstan, but he plans to return this spring to look upriver in Uzbekistan, where there are more shallow waters and braided channels that are easier to sample. He believes they're there, and that the next expedition may be the one that resurfaces that spindled prehistoric long-sought fish. "I'll recognize it the minute the water breaks," Cahuta says, "and my head will spin on my neck." Well, next we're going to head to Washington, D.C. to learn more about the art of bonsai and pinyin. Now, as Wikipedia explains, bonsai is the Japanese art of growing and shaping miniature trees in containers. Pinyin, also known as pinsai, is an ancient Chinese art of depicting artistically formed trees and other plants into miniature landscapes. Now, our article is about the tiny forest of a bonsai giant. It's written by Becky Little with photographs by Rebecca Hale, and the story is featured in the February 2025 issue of National Geographic. The ancient art of bonsai may look deceptively simple, but its practice requires care, contemplation, and consistency over long periods of time, especially if you're growing an entire miniature forest like the famous living artifact known as Goshin. This bonsai was started more than 70 years ago when Japanese-American bonsai artist John Naka cut the top off a mature juniper tree and planted it in a pot. Over the next two decades, he surrounded it with 10 more trees, one to honor each of his grandchildren. He named this miniature forest Goshin, which means protector of the spirit in Japanese. Today, Goshin is on display at the National Bonsai and Pinyin Museum, part of the National Arboretum in Washington, D.C., with the important distinction of being one of the world's best-known bonsai arrangements. Naka died in 2004 at the age of 89, but spent the last decades of his life teaching curators how to continue to care for the forest according to his vision. "For a tree to be healthy, you have to let it grow out and gain strength," says Michael James, curator at the museum. "But when you do that, it can get out of shape. It doesn't look like a bonsai anymore, so then you have to cut it back. That means no bonsai is ever truly finished. With proper attention, Goshin could live on for years." While bonsai is a historic Japanese art form dating back centuries, early artists were likely inspired by the Japanese practice of pinyin, which can be traced to the Han Dynasty some 2,000 years ago. Pinyin involves creating miniature potted landscapes that can include trees, rocks, water, human and animal figurines, and other features. But what sets bonsai arrangements apart is their sole focus on maintaining small trees with specific techniques for shaping that allow them to resemble much larger specimens. Naka, who was born in Fort Lupton, Colorado, discovered the practice after he moved at age 8 with his parents to their home country of Japan. There, his grandfather introduced him to the art of bonsai. Naka returned to Colorado in his 20s and eventually settled in Los Angeles, where he helped found the California Bonsai Society. In the decades that followed, he became nationally and worldwide known as both an artist and a teacher. Naka gave Goshin to the National Bonsai and Pinjing Museum in 1984. Today, Goshin stands out among Naka's bonsai designs because of how large its trees are. It stands nearly 5 feet at its tallest point and how closely Naka was able to place them together. This is particularly difficult to do without overpruning the roots, which can cause the trees to wither and die. He would come every year and help the museum curators work on Goshin, James says about Naka's dedication to teaching the art to others. We're trying to preserve how he would have. What a fascinating story there about this bonsai. And I want to share with you some graphic captions that accompany this story. And I'll just take each one as they appear. We have this picture of this bonsai forest that they're talking about. It's beautifully photographed, these green leaves and standing no more than 5 feet tall, many of them just inches from the floor. And you see lichen also at the base of these trees because there's a lot of shadowing going on. Now, in the first caption for the birds in bonsai art, foliage and branches should have space between them to help each arrangement feel distinct. As artist John Naka reportedly quipped, leave room for the birds to fly through. Next, we have the structural support. Now, bonsai artists use wires to make branches soar or sag, adding to the illusion that the trees are much larger than they actually are. This wire pulls a branch toward the ground, and you can barely see these wires. They're they're not invisible, but they're very hard to see. You have to take a moment to really find them out, and it really is an art. It really is. Now, bearing it all, when lightning strikes tall trees, it can result in dead spires that rise above the foliage. Nude trunks at the top of the Goshin mimic this phenomenon, and they have about three of those shorter ones and then one tall one in the center here to show in this forest. Now, what do we have? Well, we have a bonsai forest. And when? Well, started in the 1950s and continues to the present. And this is at the National Bonsai and Pinjing Museum in Washington, D.C. And finally, we have the big and small. Bigger trees may draw the eye at first, but Naka believed the most important in bonsai arrangements are both the largest and the smallest. The littlest tree at the back gives depth to Goshin. And so you look at that small tree, and that gives you a perspective, and it takes you right to the other edges of the forest. And there you have this miniature forest. You also have trunk textures. Bonsai artists create areas on the tree that resemble deadwood, portions that lose their bark and are bleached by sunlight. Stripped branches are known as gin, while barkless trees are called shirai. And then we have tree types. Bonsai can be crafted from a wide range of trees. And for this forest, Naka chose the Chinese juniper, whose immature, needle-like foliage offers opportunities for sculpting. And then finally, putting down roots. An important part is cultivating exposed roots called nebrari that flare out from the base, making smaller trees resemble much larger ones. There you go, a lesson on bonsai and the end of our journey for today's Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mike Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, reminding you the content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired, and our program available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please direct them to 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.